then is Steve Witkoff, Donald Trump's Mr. Fix-It on Gaza, Ukraine, and now Iran, in Paris this Thursday alongside Marco Rubio, the Secretary of State. Sticklers for protocol would normally insist that Rubio is the bill topper of this Diplo tour, but these aren't normal times. Does the 67-year-old New York real estate mogul hold sway? And can he do better than career policymakers? When Witkoff picks up on the Kremlin's talking points, does it mean Washington's turned on Ukraine for good? Who in Europe to keep Witkoff and Trump on side? Macron, or perhaps Italy's prime minister, the far-right's Giorgia Meloni, the only EU leader present at Trump's inauguration, back at the White House? Does she soon face a moment of choice on Ukraine, NATO bases in her own country, tariffs? Today in the France 24 debate, we're just looking at how to navigate Trump's art of the deal diplomacy with us, France 24 international affairs editor Kedavan Gorgestani. How are you?
Good.
Good to see you. Good to see former U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of Defense Jim Townsend. Thanks for joining us again.
Great to be here.
Manlio Graziano, professor of geopolitics at the French Political Science Institute, Sciences Po. You've written about J.D. Vance, who's coming to Rome, by the way.
Okay. Tomorrow. Good for Romans.
Okay. Journalist Emma Kate Simons, columnist for the New European and Franc Tireur digital web magazine. How are you?
Fine. How are you?
All right. You can listen. That's right. Listen, like, and subscribe to the France 24 debate wherever podcasts are streamed. Yeah, Steve Witkoff, he started out buying residential buildings in poor neighborhoods of New York City, made the switch to office and luxury hotels, and stayed friends throughout with fellow New York real estate mogul Donald Trump. Anthony Kerrigan has more on the U.S. president's man in Paris.
Among the U.S. envoys at the Élysée Palace on Thursday for talks with President Macron was Steve Witkoff.
By the way, this is beautiful. You know what this looks like? This actually looks like President Trump's club at Mar-a-Lago.
Really?
Adding proudly that President Trump himself is the brain behind the decor at his Florida beach club. Friends for the last four decades, the two men are in business together, their families are close, and Witkoff has even testified for Trump in court. His official title is Special Envoy to the Middle East, but with his hands in Gaza, Iran, and Ukraine portfolios, his bio on X leads with ambassador at large. He dismisses his total lack of foreign policy experience as a problem in his new role. A real estate tycoon like Donald Trump, he spurns many of the diplomatic niceties and sees his business-minded worldview as an asset. Witkoff was dispatched to Tel Aviv in January, not yet in post, where he broke with convention by refusing to wait for the end of the Sabbath for his audience with Benjamin Netanyahu. And he's since travelled solo without any government aides to Russia for talks on Ukraine, eclipsing the official regional envoy Keith Kellogg. A personal emissary of Donald Trump and foreign policy body double, he told the Wall Street Journal last week that he agrees with almost every one of Trump's policies.
You heard Keith Kellogg, head of Gorgestani, mentioned in that report. Before Trump's inauguration, we thought that former general would be the point man on Ukraine.
Yes, and he is technically still the U.S. envoy for Ukraine, but Steve Witkoff is the man that we see everywhere. And part of the reporting is supposedly because Witkoff was seen by Donald Trump and by some in the administration as being a little bit too pro-Ukrainian, and that is why he was sort of pushed a little bit aside in favor of Steve Witkoff that has really the whole trust of Donald Trump. That is why we're seeing him everywhere. He's really someone who's been loyal to Donald Trump throughout those past 30 to 40 years. And for the foreign policy apparatus, the leaders around the world, they know that Steve Witkoff has Donald Trump's ear, and they know that when Steve Witkoff speaks, it's likely the exact message that Donald Trump wants to send.
And you wrote about this, Emma-Kate Simons, in Franc-Tireur.
Yes, I mean, Witkoff is really like a clone of Donald Trump. Yeah, it's like he's like Trump, but less abrasive. He seems slightly more approachable. But if you scratch vaguely beneath the surface, you'll see they're the same kind of character. They grew up, or they're in business terms, in this sort of cutthroat 1980s New York real estate world. Witkoff started out as a lawyer, and then he was in such admiration. He thought Trump was the Michael Jordan of real estate, that he himself went into real estate development, did many deals, some of them quite dodgy. Eventually in 2023, he sold the Park Lane Hotel to the Qatar Investment Authority. But he's his golfing partner, his friend, and he's intensely pro-Putin. Like Trump, he's in admiration of Vladimir Putin.
Pro-Putin?
Absolutely. Because he's met him three times in the past couple of months.
Right.
He did a hand on his heart when he went there last Friday, just before Putin launched a war crime attack, killing scores of civilians in Sumy in Ukraine.
Pro-Putin, is that how you would describe Steve Witkoff?
I don't know him as well as you know, so I cannot say anything about him in particular. What I can say is that this is something I insist very much with my students. If you do politics, you have to be a professional of politics. And we see it's not just the case of Witkoff, it's the case of everybody starting from the president. People who have no idea about politics and they want to be in politics. So this is the huge, and I think even the worst problem that has.
Because they would answer, well, you wouldn't know how to run a business, and
exactly.
How dare you say that?
Exactly. I say business is one thing and politics is another thing.
Mm.
And everybody has to make what they are able to do and not invade the field of others because they are not able to do it. And we have a lot of proofs of that.
Let's talk about an image earlier in the day in Paris. Steve Witkoff, welcomed by France's President Emmanuel Macron's top diplomatic advisor, Emmanuel Beaune. And you can see in these images, sitting next to Beaune on his right is the UK's national security advisor, Jonathan Powell, the same Powell there you see him shaking hands. There you see Steve Witkoff, rather, shaking hands with Macron. Powell, who was Tony Blair's chief negotiator in Northern Ireland's Good Friday agreements, but we don't see him in those images, but we'll see. But he was there, I promise you. Tim Townsend, let me ask you about this, the contrast. So Jonathan Powell and Steve Witkoff in the same room, your thoughts?
Well, I'm glad Jonathan Powell is there because Witkoff needs some professional advice. And my understanding is both Powell as well as his French colleague, over the past few weeks, they either are on the phone or in Washington giving advice to Witkoff and his team on how to put together the structure of these talks, whether it's with the Iranians, whether it's with Gaza. These are things that these professional diplomats who are experienced know how to do, and Witkoff knows he needs their advice. So I'm happy to see Jonathan there.
And so he's been listening?
You know, I think Witkoff has. I think Witkoff strikes me, and I'm not an expert like you all, but he strikes me as not so full of hubris that he's not going to listen to people. He's going to fob them off. It sounds like to me Witkoff is willing to listen to people who know how to deal with Russians or Iranians, and that's not developers in Manhattan. That's the A-team in negotiations. So I think Witkoff does listen to that advice.
Emma-Kate Simons?
Well, I think, no, he listens, but I think we do need to take him at his word. And so he did this interview with Tucker Carlson, the far-right former Fox News presenter.
That was a couple
in
weeks
March,
back. Yeah.
In March, where he said that he found Putin to be an extremely intelligent and smart guy, not a bad guy, gracious. And he went on the attack on Vladimir Zelensky. He even said that Ukraine was like a fake country. He mouthed the Kremlin talking points about these of four areas in Ukraine that he said, these zones that he said that Russia should just be able to take back. So basically, if you take him at his word, he's always running the Kremlin line. It's very alarming.
All right, let's listen. Donald Trump earlier this week accused of running the Kremlin line when he ignored the proven facts of Vladimir Putin's invasion of Ukraine and told the Ukrainians that they shouldn't have picked on a neighbor, quote, 20 times their size. And this after Witkoff had returned from a 5-hour meeting at the Kremlin. Steve Witkoff who spoke on Fox News a couple of days ago.
This peace deal is about these so-called five territories, but there's so much more to it. There's security protocols. There's no NATO, NATO, Article 5. I mean, it's just, you know, a lot of detail attached to it. It's a complicated situation.
Complicated situation. Kedavan Gorgiastani, was he channeling the Kremlin's line or simply explaining what Vladimir Putin told him?
Well, the issue here is probably that he was simply repeating what Vladimir Putin was telling him. The problem, if you're sitting on the side of the Ukrainians or the Europeans, is that there was no pushback to this idea by Vladimir Putin that he wants to basically, in a deal, take control of the five regions, meaning we're talking about the four eastern Ukrainian regions, and he's throwing in Crimea in there. And I think the problem or the issue that especially Vladimir Zelensky finds when he criticizes Witkoff and says he said it again, that he's feeding the lines of the Kremlin, is partly that, which is that he's simply repeating the lines of the Kremlin without giving any pushback from the U.S. position. Seemingly, at least when you listen to the comments in public, seemingly just going along with every single thing that the Russians have demanded so far. The Americans have yet to put any pressure. We heard Donald Trump say he was frustrated with Vladimir Putin, but concretely, there's been no pressure on the Russians the way there's been pressure on Vladimir Zelensky.
Right, that bit about the five regions sticking in the throat of Ukraine's president. Let's listen to Volodymyr Zelensky.
Ukraine is a sovereign state, and all territories belong to the state of Ukraine. And only the people of Ukraine can speak about the territories of our country. You know, for us, these are red lines. To recognize any temporarily occupied territories not as Ukrainian, but as Russian. These representatives discuss issues outside their competence.
Representatives discussing issues outside their competence. Clearly, he's talking about Steve Witkoff there. Was Volodymyr Zelensky right to speak up, or is that a tactical mistake in trying to onboard Donald Trump?
Well, it's probably a tactical mistake because of his torturous relationship with Trump. But I'm glad he spoke up. Someone has to say that. And my understanding is that part of the agenda for the European nations meeting in Paris is to try to have Witkoff be have some more stick, as they say, you know, to instead of just throwing carrots towards the Russians, use a stick on Putin to get him to the table, be tougher. So, you know, I'm glad Zelensky spoke up. And I understand, too, actually, as Witkoff is going to fly to Rome after he's finished here. He's going to talk to the Iranians. And there's concern that he have around him at the table, Witkoff, people who understand nuclear, you know, the nuclear questions that are going to be discussed. Because obviously, this developer isn't an expert on nuclear warfare and nuclear power and all the things that are happening with Tehran. So I think there is a lot of concern, whether it's from Zelensky or others, that Witkoff doesn't necessarily have all the details right.
So how does this differ from Donald Trump's first term when his son-in-law, Jared Kushner, was suddenly the man of the hour when it came to mediation?
I would say it's a very close example of a similar thing. They are looking for people to do that kind of job who are loyalist to Trump, number one. That's the major thing. The upside to that is at least Witkoff has Trump's ear, as was said. And not many people have Trump's ear, certainly not in the Washington area. So at least if you're negotiating with the United States, you're talking to someone who's going to go back and talk to Donald Trump, even though he doesn't know a whole lot.
Manley Gertin, you have present again in Paris top representatives from Ukraine who were here. There was the foreign minister and Volodymyr Zelensky's envoy, but also the UK foreign secretary, the top national security advisor from Germany. Your thoughts on who was sitting there in the room talking with Steve Witkoff?
There are people who are trying to find a way to move in these messy situations. So I think, as you said, that they are expert in what they do, and they have to deal with people who are not. So they have, first of all, they have to recognize the people they are talking with. They have to take the measures of them. Because it's, so far, Europeans in general, and I include the Britons in this case, they are trying to move day by day. And it's normal, because in a situation like this one, it's impossible to make a strategy or something longer than 1 week, because in 1 week, everything can change. So they have at least to take the measure of the people they are talking with, to try to understand what... But what I think is what you were saying now...
And we're seeing, by the way, in these images there we just saw a moment ago, the U.S. Secretary of State and the U.K. Foreign Secretary.
Yeah, we talk about Rubio again, maybe later. But the problem is that when you talk with those people, and this is what we were discussing just a moment earlier, you probably have some very decent answers to what you want to hear. But when they go back to Washington, they can change 180 degrees. So this is the problem. You cannot deal with people who are... speaking, are talking, but when they go home, they can say exactly the opposite that they said to you.
That's true, but I think it is significant. This is the first time that talks have been held that actually involved all the parties and Europe. Crucially, the Europeans, the European nations, the Ukrainians, the Americans, because it started, Witkoff started only dealing with Putin. And then he had talks in the Middle East that was also just with the Russians, basically, excluding the Europeans from the table. And today we have Giorgia Meloni, Italy's leader, over there talking to Trump. She's pro-Ukraine, but it's all within the context of the tariffs that Trump is, you know, slamming on the entire world, including Europe. So there's a lot of things going on at the same time, but I think you're right that this is basically a chance. Yes, he could go back and just do what he wants afterwards, but at least he is listening to Europe. They realize that it's not moving, but it seems to me that Witkoff and Trump, they just want Ukraine to
surrender.
You are
much more optimistic than me.
That's what they want.
If we take this, like, take it one day at a time attitude, then... what's the point of the French defense minister who is currently in Washington going to visit his U.S. counterpart?
Well, if you read the statement of the French defense ministry as he was heading to Washington, the idea was to work on Ukraine on the military side, so discuss probably the question of the so-called coalition of the willing and how concretely this would come up. If you read the readout from the U.S. Defense Department after the meeting, the only sort of concrete line that there is there is basically a scolding of the French and Pete Hegseth asking the French to spend more on their defense. This is, of course, referencing the 2% of military spending to reach the NATO levels, except Donald Trump now wants 5%. So it was a little bit of an awkward sort of before and after the meeting, but it was probably mostly just to discuss the military aspect and to, it seems, for the Europeans, it's sort of all hands on deck. We do meetings in Paris, we do meetings in D.C., we send Meloni, we send Le Cornu, we have the foreign ministers here. And at this point, they're willing to try probably anything they can.
So at this point in time, is it the Trump administration swayed by the last person they meet with? Or is there a genuine effort to get allies to stop supporting Ukraine militarily?
Well, that's the question. And I think when the ministers met today, I think for sure Hegseth put the arm on his French counterpart, saying you need to pull back on the assistance to Ukraine, giving the reasons we've all heard. They're not going to win. This is a terrible war. You're just making it worse. But he's also doing that to curry favor in Moscow. So that's the worst part of it, is whether they're reciting talking points or they're actually doing the bidding of the Russians to go to allies and also have them pull back on assistance to Ukraine.
And which of the two is it?
Well, I think in the meeting today in the Pentagon, I'm sure Hegseth talked about defense spending, but that's a throwaway talking point. We're always going to talk about that. I think it was a full court press. To get France to stand up and say, okay, we'll pull back for the sake of ending the war. And France isn't going to do that, and neither will the UK or the other Europeans.
Yes, you're absolutely right, because at the same time, it's like a coordinated effort between Moscow and Washington. The Russian foreign ministry issued a direct warning to Germany. They said if that they were to supply Taurus missiles to Kiev, it would be considered direct participation in the Ukrainian war. So you have Hegseth doing the bidding.
But we've heard these kinds of threats for 3 years, haven't we? We've even had nuclear threats.
It's crunch time now, I think. I mean, when you look at the extent of this war crime that occurred only last weekend on Palm Sunday, and the lack of outrage.
The missile attack in Sumy.
Yes.
Right. With cluster munitions.
Cluster munitions, scores of men, women, and children, some of them going to church on Palm Sunday. Where's the MAGA outrage at the attacks on Christians? It barely registers. And Trump even said that the attack was probably a mistake. Yeah. Like, even more than Russia, he does Russia talking points.
Yeah.
Which brings us to the topic of Italy's prime minister.
Okay, thank you very much.
Because Manlio Graziano, since Inauguration Day, when Giorgia Meloni was present in Washington, she made a subsequent trip to Mar-a-Lago, she says, I can be the bridge. But going to the Oval Office, as we've seen since that time, can sometimes be tricky, whether it's Volodymyr Zelensky getting ambushed or even Benjamin Netanyahu, to a certain degree, surprised, even though they're close allies, but what Trump said in his company when there's that press pool that comes into the meeting room for the photo op. So was this a smart move by Meloni to go to Washington at this time?
I think Meloni has a different task there, because it's not just... I don't think she's sent by the European Union. She decided to go.
So she did speak with Ursula von der Leyen before.
Yeah, of course, at least... it's not that much. But in any case, yes. She has a huge problem at home, first of all, because she's in coalition and her deputy prime minister is Matteo Salvini, who is openly pro-Russian, always been. He insists very much, and he insisted very much before she started, about the fact that she's there to speak about the Italian interest, not European interest. And she should put Italian interest before European interest. This is an old story about the legislation, local national legislation is more important than the European legislation. So Salvini is very close to this position. So she has to maintain the majority she has in Parliament in Italy, which is very delicate because, of course, this is a competition among populists. So she can very easily lose the majority. And the other side is that she's going bring with her a message. But we will see first, as you said, the reaction, because in this Oval Office, in these days, everything can happen. But I think she will be well received. Donald Trump was very kind with her because they are very close, finally. So I think she will be. It will not be the same welcome that Angela Merkel received.
For the first time. Yeah, that was a frosty reception.
Yeah.
Okay, so a couple of follow-up questions here. You heard Jim Townsend a moment ago saying how the French and the British are not going to blink when it comes to their support for Ukraine. We saw Russia's president showing recently largesse, if you will, towards Italy, returning the local affiliate of Ariston back to the Italian maker of home heating systems and boilers. Ariston's assets were seized a year ago by Moscow. Now they can have them back. Could Giorgia Meloni waver when it comes to her support for Ukraine?
In my opinion, she already did, in the sense that she told openly that she will not follow any kind of coalition of willing. So this is already a clear position. And again, if you go to a negotiation and you start saying, I will not harm you, I will not ask you anything, it's very difficult to obtain some results in general. So I'm not sure that you will have, probably on things like that, yes, because of course Putin is doing his job. Putin is not like Donald Trump. He knows what he does. So when he makes this kind of a gift to Italy, is because he knows that he can put an edge between Italy and the rest of the European Union, which is pretty easy because Italy has this problem in Rome.
And one final question on this, because there's a blurring of lines between business contracts and national security with Elon Musk, who's been trying to sell his Starlink low-orbit satellite system to the Italians. Will that be what the discussion is about behind closed doors?
It's very easy because she's very close to Elon Musk. So,
but how will Italians take it? Are they in favor of this deal?
You know, I don't follow very much what they say in Italy because I live here. I follow what happens here much more than what is. But when I see that Salvini is so popular and Meloni is even more popular than him, I can understand that Italians are much closer to Americans in their way of thinking. In any case, what I'm sure is that all the parties, right, center, left, whatever, they are against this war, and they would like Italy to withdraw as much as possible from this mess in Ukraine. This is the common position of the parties. Then the population, the feeling of population, I don't know because I'm not there.
But sure. But of course, we're talking here, we've been talking about, you've been in Paris, Jim Townsend, talking about strategic autonomy. These Starlink contracts, what's their future at this point with the European continent?
Well, you know, I'm not sure what alternative there is. If you need the kind of capability that Starlink provides, you don't have much of an alternative. And that's what Europe has got to start getting really good at in terms of developing a European version of this. So you're not dependent on Elon Musk. Ukraine being dependent on Elon Musk is not a very good thing either. So I think, you know, strategic autonomy, though, I think its day has come. You know, Macron has spoken about that. It has been mocked in Washington for a number of years, strategic autonomy. But at the end of the day, as my students say at Sciences Po, de Gaulle was right. And I think Macron is right. And strategic autonomy is what can bring a breaking of the dependence Europe has on the United States on things like Starlink or military types of things. This is Europe's time. It's going to take a long time, and it's going to take money, and it's going to take effort. But I think to get to the bottom of a lot of things, that's got to work.
Yeah, the United States with more than 12,000 troops still in Italy today. That's not counting, of course, family, non-uniformed personnel. We can show you this recent map, Kedavan Gorgistani. And, you know, it's not just soldiers, of course. And imagine the political fallout, because there's the long term, the strategic autonomy, as you heard Jim Townsend say, takes time. But in the short term, if those U.S. troops pack up and go, a lot of local communities will be reeling.
Absolutely. And this is something that is not just specific to Italy, because, of course, you can think about Germany that also has huge U.S. troop presence. And there are other countries in Europe who have that troop presence. So everywhere that the U.S. is present in a significant number, it comes with the armada of what a U.S. base implies, which is often schools for the American children and everything that goes along with it, stores, things like that. And it does help, in a way, the local economy. So that is something that will likely not happen overnight, because Donald Trump has hinted at the fact that he might withdraw part of the troops. But for now, I think the focus, at least according to the reporting that there is on that decision, is to focus on the, I believe, 20,000 that Biden had asked to be sent after the Russian invasion of Ukraine. So he's not talking about removing the troops that were there before the Russian invasion. And so it wouldn't change completely what the European countries have been living with for years now. But down the road, if that removal of troops is something that he wants to keep doing, then maybe we could get into that situation.
And we know that Putin is talking about that to Witkoff. A wonderful goal that Putin has is to get U.S. troops out of Europe one way or another. So you're absolutely right. That 20,000 is something that it's easy pickings, if you will, because they were just sent there a few years ago. They can be brought back. But I've also heard that they might be reducing forces, not necessarily in Italy, but in Germany, that have been there for a while. And that's something that's music to Putin's ears. And so that's more concessions that
we're making. But weren't you just saying a moment ago that Europe needs more strategic autonomy? If those U.S. troops leave, then the slack gets picked up by the Europeans.
Right. And strategic autonomy over time is going to help the Europeans do that. But your point about timing is exactly right. If those troops are pulled out over the next year or two, Europe will not be in a place to fill those gaps. Not yet.
I'm Kate Simons.
Yeah, but I think there's a recognition finally, especially since Liberation Day and the tariffs, even there was a slight flip-flop, that Europe is on its own. I think Ursula von der Leyen, she said that the West as we knew it doesn't exist anymore. Europe is still supporting the rules-based order. It's not going to counter the sovereignty of other nations. It still believes in the international institutions, the international global liberal order. But the United States clearly no longer under Donald Trump believes in that. And in fact, there was a very good article in Foreign Affairs about how the U.S. is gravitating towards a position as a rogue superpower.